Masters of Art, Science, and Deception.
I'm very interested in how art and politics play against each other. And if you're interested in those two things, or that thing, there's really no better artist to talk about than Rubens.
That's Mark Lamster. We'll talk with him about the great Flemish Baroque painter's career as an unofficial diplomat for the Spanish crown.
So at the time, England's a very nervous country. There's a lot of conspiracies. There's a lot of unease, a lot of surveillance, and I think there's sort of parallels with, you know, what's going on now. There's a real sort of nervousness that there might be these kind of cells of young men plotting to bring down the country around the place. And so into this comes Bruno.
And that's mystery writer S.J. Paris, talking about Renaissance scientist Giordano Bruno and his visit to Oxford in 1583. She spins a murder mystery around the visit and around Bruno's mission as a spy for the English crown. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we think of the Flemish artist Peter Paul Rubens, most of us call up visions of amply endowed naked women and plump cherubs cavorting on a massive canvas. Rubens was the most sought-after painter of his time for the major and minor royalty of Europe. He was a shrewd businessman who levered his career as an artist into fabulous wealth. But he also had a hidden career as a secret diplomat for the Spanish crown. His hometown was Antwerp in Flanders. Along with Holland, Flanders was part of the Low Countries, at that time colonies of Spain. And while Flanders was a docile colony, Holland was in the throes of a revolt against colonial rule. When the Dutch blockaded Antwerp, they choked off the vital artery of commerce that fed Flanders' prosperity. Rubens wanted peace. He spent years trying to broker a peace deal for Spain, playing the great diplomatic game between the European powers. He didn't live to see peace come. But the story of his efforts affords a fascinating window into the history of his time and the character of Rubens, a charismatic, pragmatic, artistic genius. Mark Lamster has written that story. He writes on arts and culture for Design Observer and the Los Angeles Times and is a member of the National Book Critics Circle. His book is Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of Peter Paul Rubens. We spoke in January. Lamster met me in, appropriately, an artist's loft in Soho. I started out by asking him why he wanted to write a book about Rubens.
I'm very interested in how art and politics play against each other. And if you're interested in those two things, or that thing, there's really no better artist to talk about than Rubens, because he was both a great artist, obviously, and people know a little bit less, but also a terrific diplomat. So he's really the ideal vessel to talk about those two things.
I have to say, first of all, that Rubens has never been one of my favorite painters. A little too Baroque for me, but I have a far greater appreciation of him now after having read your book than I ever did before then. And I don't think I'm alone in this. I think Rubens, you know, seen as one of the greatest masters of his time during his time, has no longer been seen that way. Why did that happen?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think Rubens is one of these painters who's a little bit hidden in plain sight. We think of Rubens, we think of, you know, fat, naked women, basically, and those aren't so fashionable these days. And also, when we think of Rubens, his paintings, they're these huge canvases. They have mythological and allegorical and biblical subjects. And I think modern audiences just have a hard time understanding those. We don't really know those subjects so well anymore. We're not as familiar with that kind of language anymore. So we have a tendency to look at them just in purely formal terms. They're confusing, they're big, and we kind of say, oh, Rubens, he's great, and we kind of move on to the next thing in the gallery. And I think there's also an aspect of Rubens' life where he was this sort of very bourgeois gentleman and not a romantic figure like, say, Caravaggio or Rembrandt or Van Gogh or Jackson Pollock. Say, I think we think about artists as these romantic, dangerous, self-destructive types. And Rubens never fell into that convention. He was a very successful businessman. He was a very stable family man, a kind of model gentleman. And that, in a way, was what allowed him to be so successful, both as a painter and as a diplomat. But in a way, it's, I think, thrown up a wall between him and modern audiences who sort of look for something else when they look for great painting.
He was a very stable bourgeois gentleman. On the other hand, he came from not quite so stable a family. There was a bit of scandal in the background of his family. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, his father was a very successful lawyer and alderman in Antwerp, Flanders, modern Belgium. And at the time, Flanders sort of dissolved. There was wars of religion in the Low Countries at that time. And for various reasons, the Rubens family was forced to flee Antwerp and their homeland. And Rubens' father wound up in Germany, and he became involved with the wife of William of Orange, who was sort of the George Washington of Holland, and had this extramarital affair with her, which was discovered. They had a child together, and this was a capital offense. So Rubens' father spent several years in prison and basically decimated the family's fortunes with his philandering behavior. And I think Rubens knew about this. This all happened before he was born, but he was well aware of the family history. And I think that sort of pushed him to be a more stable figure in his adult life. He learned the lessons of his father's behavior.
Now, what you've just said just shows how incredibly intertwined families were that were on different sides of the political struggles. You talked about William of Orange of Holland. I'm sure most of our listeners know very little, if they know anything at all, about the history that Holland at this time was under the control, was a colony of Spain, and that Antwerp and Rubens himself was an ally of the Spanish against the Dutch. Tell us, if you can, sketch out for us this history.
Right. Well, in the 16th century, the entire Low Countries, what we know today as Belgium and Holland, was a possession of Spain. And the Dutch rebelled against some very harsh Spanish rule. The Low Countries at that time were kind of like the Iraq of the 17th century and the 16th century, shall we say. Sort of this land divided by sectarian violence with this negligent foreign occupier, and that would be Spain. And Holland revolted against Spain, and Flanders, or modern Belgium, basically remained loyal. So what happened was that Flanders, where Rubens was from, became the sort of the theater of battle between Spain and Holland, who were having this prolonged war, what we now know as the 80 Years' War. This was a critical war. Spain was not concerned just with losing Holland, but because Holland had developed into this great maritime power, it was an existential threat for Spain, because Spain depended on its colonies all around the world to support its empire. And here was Holland fighting it basically around the world. This was really, the 80 Years' War was the first global war, the first world war. They were fighting in Africa, South America, North America, Asia, the subcontinent, East Asia. Really, everywhere there were men, they were fighting, in addition to Europe. So this was a conflict that Rubens became engaged in. And really, he devoted a decade of his life to try and end this war, because it was brutal for Antwerp, which really sat on the front lines in Europe of this war.
In fact, there was a case there where you talk about in the book, and I have to say, this is a fascinating book, Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens. In this amazing story of backs and forth in terms of ups and downs in the diplomatic struggle, there's a certain point where you talk about that Spain was running out of money in order to try to protect its empire. And the Dutch capture all the silver that was being brought from the New World to Spain.
For the Dutch, it was just a maritime commerce. But for Spain, it was piracy. Basically, Dutch military naval power was a threat to the Spanish treasury. They were, you know, we hear about sunken ships with treasure on them, and this is when it was happening. This is when those ships were being sunk. Basically, the Dutch Navy was shadowing Spanish military convoys and treasure convoys around the globe and trying to capture them, with some success, too. And Spain depended on that money that was being brought back from overseas to support its treasury on the homeland. And when that gold did not arrive, it caused tremendous problems in Madrid.
Now, let's get to Rubens. First of all, he's a painter. How did he get into a position, as he did here, as being the secret diplomat, trying to broker a peace, and I'm going to ask you who he tried to broker a peace with, trying to create alliances in favor of Spain's empire in the Low Countries?
Well, it was a long process. Rubens' access, because Rubens was such a popular painter among monarchs of Europe, he became a sort of perfect covert agent for the Spanish crown and for the sovereigns of Flanders. Basically, he was traveling all over the world. He was traveling to foreign capitals, and wherever he was meeting with figures in the highest at the highest level of state. So he was very well positioned to not only conduct secret behind doors affairs, but also to report back on the things that he'd seen, sort of as a spy, essentially. And in fact, he was enlisted as a spy. He was on the military payroll of the Flemish government. And as he became more and more trusted by his sovereigns, he was entrusted with more and more important affairs, until eventually he was negotiating treaties.
He was a pretty remarkable guy, too. I mean, talk a little bit about his personality. He was widely respected, and in fact, you could almost say he was a kind of charismatic figure, perhaps not charismatic in the sense of a military leader, but in a more quiet way.
He was a charismatic figure. People were naturally attracted to him. He was an incredibly bright person. You know, we talk about Renaissance men, and this was the Baroque era, but he was most certainly a Renaissance man. He could do many, many things, and many things at once. He was interested in science, in the arts, obviously. He wrote about architecture. He wrote about natural sciences. He was a classical scholar. He was very much involved in the intellectual life of Flanders, of Antwerp, but also of Europe in its entirety. And wherever he went, sort of people wanted to be around him because, you know, he was this great painter, and people liked him, and he had a reputation for being a man who was trustworthy and knowledgeable and sort of a node on this network of humanist intellectuals around Europe. That made him very a prized person when he came to visit any foreign capital.
And he knew a lot about diplomacy. He actually studied it. You talk about Machiavelli a lot. Give us a little bit about the time frame here. Would he have known of Machiavelli?
He did. He had read Machiavelli. He was a voracious reader, and especially about the things that directly pertain to his business. He read constantly about politics and diplomacy. Whenever a book came out about diplomacy in Paris or elsewhere, he would hear about it. He would make sure a copy was sent to him so he could read it. And he, in fact, consulted on a work of diplomacy written by a Brussels-based diplomat. So he was very well-versed in diplomatic theory, and also, of course, could back that up with his own personal experience in diplomatic practice.
A question that I had in reading the book, and we're talking about the book Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens, with my guest Mark Lamster, the author. A question that I had, and I have to admit, this is coming from, I mean, my father was Dutch, so I always heard the story of the fight against Spain very much from, as if I were an American colonist talking about the British, the Dutch talking about the Spanish. So the question I had in reading this book is, why was a man of such breadth of learning on the side of the colonial power rather than on the side, perhaps, of the Dutch?
Well, Rubens was a very moderate and pragmatic figure, but he was also a conservative person. His mode of changing a society was to reform it from within rather than to attack it from without. So just by virtue of where he came from and his own personal family history, it was, and his religious beliefs, it was natural that he would be loyal to Spain, although he was very disappointed and constantly aggravated by the behavior of the Spanish crown. But he felt the best way to find peace and to move forward was not to sort of try and fight that power, but to try and reform that power from within, to try and bring peace to these fighting powers rather than create more conflict.
And it was an incredibly complicated dance that he tried to do. Ultimately, his goal was to make peace with Holland because Antwerp was so disadvantaged in this. As long as this struggle was going on, in fact, in a way that the port traffic was blockaded. Maybe you could explain that. But in order to do that, he had to go through Britain. Tell us a story.
Well, Antwerp again sits on the front lines of this war between Spain and Holland. It's right at the border or near the border between what is now Belgium and what is now Holland. So it was right near where the fighting was and always in some danger. And Antwerp sits on the River Scheldt, and that's its economic lifeline. It empties into the North Sea, and the Dutch Navy had basically cut it off. It was just devastating for the Flemish homeland. So Rubens needed to figure out a way to sort of resolve this conflict, and he settled on this way, sort of this triangular diplomatic approach. I like to call it like the transitive theory of diplomacy. And his idea was that if he could make Spain an ally of England, then England, which was naturally allied with Holland, would force Holland to become allied with Spain, and that would end this war. So he undertook this basically decade-long effort to bring Spain and England to peace. And this was no small task. If you recall that Spain and England had been enemies, vicious enemies for decades, and is still there remains hostility between the two countries. And, you know, the Spanish Armada was sunk by the British Navy in 1588. So there's a long history of conflict there. And he managed to actually get these two powers to come to peace. It's almost like, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union coming to peace. They were really superpowers and opposed superpowers. And he managed to bring them to the table. It was an extraordinary accomplishment. It did not, in the end, result in the peace that he had ultimately hoped for, which was between Holland and Spain. But just by itself, it was quite a considerable coup.
And we should say that it wasn't too long after his death that that peace between Holland and Spain actually did happen.
It did, pretty much on Holland's terms as well. Yeah, in 1548, sadly, after his death, the 80 Years' War and also the 30 Years' War, which was concurrent and happening in Germany, sort of came to an end.
Now, one of the things that also surprised me, there are a lot of important historical figures who are brought together in the story who I'd always heard about separately. For example, Cardinal Richelieu of France. Tell us what France's role was here, a kind of a spoiler in a way, and talk about Richelieu also. Who was he and his importance in this story?
Richelieu was the foreign minister of France, the most powerful figure in France because the king was sort of not incredibly interested in ruling his own kingdom and had ceded most authority to Richelieu. And Richelieu was actually a patron of Rubens. He admired Rubens as a painter, and Rubens admired Richelieu as a statesman. But they were natural enemies because France and Spain were natural enemies. And that meant that whatever diplomatic objectives Rubens was ever trying to achieve, Richelieu would always be there trying to block them. And in fact, Richelieu's original patron was Marie de Medici, who is probably Rubens' most famous client. Listeners may know the Medici cycle of paintings that Rubens made for the Luxembourg Palace, which was Marie's palace, and those paintings are now one of the glories of the Louvre. But Marie and Richelieu fell out repeatedly, and he ended up banishing her, and she ended up on Rubens' doorstep, and he ended up loaning her money, which is the ultimate irony of Rubens, a commoner, loaning money to a queen of France, let alone a Medici. So Richelieu, who we know most famously from the Dumas novels, Three Musketeers, where he appears, was certainly one of the foremost diplomatic strategists and thinkers of that period, and someone Rubens was dealing with, and in fact had some success dealing with as a diplomat in his career.
No small feat.
Not at all. Not at all.
So let's talk a little bit now about the art. As you mentioned, that Rubens produced a cycle, a very famous cycle of paintings for Maria de Medici. Also, of course, he did for the King of Spain. He did for the Pope as well. I mean, all the greats of Europe, the King of England, for that matter. Tell us about how the art and the politics intertwined here in furthering Rubens' ambitions, both as a painter as well as a diplomat.
As a painter, Rubens had access to to major figures in the political world because they so enjoyed his paintings. And he could also send messages with his paintings about the nature of war, the nature of politics. Whether those were received or not depended on the circumstance. And oftentimes, he was in a precarious position with Marie de Medici, who he, as we've discussed, painted this long cycle about. She had led this very difficult, not especially wonderful life, and here he was stuck trying to celebrate it in an entire series of canvases of great scale. And that was a serious challenge because she hadn't done so many wonderful things. And in fact, there were a lot of, it was basically a political minefield for what he could and could not paint. In fact, the pictures ended up being quite abstract in many ways. What exactly was happening in some of them was really obscure, so that you could kind of interpret them however you wanted.
Give us an example.
A great example from the Medici cycle would be one of the paintings called The Felicity of Her Regency. It was actually a replacement for another picture that was deemed inappropriate. And here, Marie, who is not an especially attractive woman, was painted as this beautiful goddess-like figure, naked at the breast, surrounded by these figures supporting her. And it was just a patently ridiculous proposition, but also kind of a fantastic painting.
So Rubens definitely knew how to flatter his clients.
There was no one better at sort of presenting clients the way they wanted to be seen rather than the way they were. He had a way of appealing to figures of great power, figures who ruled by divine right, that made them especially comfortable and appealed to their native sense of grandeur and power.
Well, I'm talking with Mark Lamster. He's the author of Master of Shadows. It's about the secret diplomatic career of the painter Peter Paul Rubens. Rubens actually became a member of the nobility himself, born a commoner. How common was this, and how did this happen?
Well, it happened not that unusually. Rubens became so amazingly wealthy that he was actually worth more than many of the nobles who were basically protesting his elevation to that status or looked unkindly upon him. He was elevated to the nobility essentially because diplomatic work was really the work of the aristocracy, and it was difficult for him to conduct political affairs as a commoner, and it became essentially a political expedience for him to have his status raised, which was essentially the reason why the Spanish king elevated his position, also out of gratitude for his work and because he was such a distinguished figure And then, so he was first elevated to nobility in Spain, and then Charles I, the king of England, also granted him a title of nobility as a matter of gratitude because he so admired him. Charles I really, really, really admired Rubens. In fact, he asked Rubens to supply him with a self-portrait, that is, Rubens would paint himself and send it to the king. Rubens at first didn't even want to do this. He thought that was inappropriate that a commoner would send a self-portrait to a king, especially from another land. He thought that was a strange, weird request. And then actually Charles hung it outside his bedroom so he could look at it all the time, which was definitely weird.
Why do you think Charles liked him so much?
Well, Charles, for its own reasons, was especially interested in art and was especially interested in raising the status of his own court. And one of the ways he did that was by sort of this art patronage program that would elevate the status of his dynasty to the level of the dynasties in Madrid, in Paris, in Rome, in Florence. And there was really no better painter in the world than Rubens. So it was kind of a natural attraction.
So I want to ask you about doing the research on this. I'm sure most of this history is more or less known in some way. I mean, you weren't doing like deep archival research.
The hard thing about Rubens isn't so much discovering new material. It's assimilating the enormous catalog of material that's been written, that's been generated, you know, in 400 years of history. I don't think any painter has been written about with such frequency as Rubens, because he has all these different aspects of his life. He's appealed to historians for generation after generation after generation. He's left a long track record of correspondence. So there's just an enormous amount of material, and I think the challenge of any writer is to take all that material and distill a story from it that is true to that history, but also is compelling as a story, as a narrative in its own right.
And this story that you tell certainly is compelling. Yet, in spite of all this work that's been done, would you say that outside of maybe academia that there's been, this was new to me, in other words, I guess I'm saying, and I don't know if it was new to me just because I was ignorant, or whether, you know, when you say the secret diplomatic career, this is not very well known that he was really involved, not in a general sense.
No, I think people don't know it. I mean, I think people, first of all, just don't know Rubens that well, just because he's so hard and difficult. I think art historians tend to look at his diplomatic work as ancillary, not really a central aspect of his artistic career, and sort of they mention it or talk about it briefly, but it's not primarily what they're interested in writing about. And political historians have a tendency to gloss over this whole period to begin with, and because the treaties that Rubens negotiated sort of fell by the wayside and Spain was in the end the loser in history of this period, his accomplishments have been neglected. So in a way, he's managed to fall through the cracks in both disciplines, which is a shame. I think to understand his painting, maybe you don't need to understand the political history, but it becomes so much richer. The work becomes so much more powerful when you understand this period and what he was working on in the background, because political affairs are so much a part of what he was doing. They're sometimes a subtext, and sometimes they are the direct subject of his work. And to really appreciate that, I think you need a little bit of that context. And once you have it, it opens up this painter who's hidden in plain sight, shall we say. And we have some of the richest, most powerful works in the history of art, and they just open up to you. To me, that was one of the reasons to write this book.
In reading this book, I kept on thinking about modern parallels. Particularly the cost of war to empire and how empires fall. You mentioned the word pragmatist before. He was pragmatic. Of course, that's a word that's being used a lot to describe President Obama. Could you talk a little bit about some of the lessons that you drew from this history, when you were done with the book, what did you come up with in terms of what we could take away from this for today?
Well, one of the reasons I started writing it was because I felt like the story was so resonant with current affairs. I started writing it at the time the Iraq war was burning at its hottest and seemed most intractable. And this story of a land divided by sectarian violence with a foreign occupier that was quite negligent seemed especially pertinent. And Antwerp actually had all these parallels with Baghdad. It was one of the few cities that had a green zone. The Spanish occupying force actually had built the citadel adjacent to Antwerp to defend themselves from the natives of Antwerp. And if you think about it, this is an incredibly unusual architectural typology. Normally, a city builds a citadel to protect itself from foreigners. Here, from foreign invaders. Here, the foreign invaders had built the citadel to protect themselves from the natives. So you kind of couldn't help but sort of see the parallels between them. And I think as you just study history, the more you see how it becomes more and more relevant. I think, you know, during the presidential election, this we were talking about whether we should or should not be negotiating with Iran, this idea of is continuous negotiation fruitful or not fruitful. And I think one of the great lessons of this book and of this period was that you always keep your channels of negotiation open because you never know. History can change on a dime, and situations can change on a dime. You never know when your history, when your enemy is going to become your friend, and it's necessary to always have your channels open. And this was Rubens' enemies felt this. Rubens felt this. Actually, Richelieu actually wrote an entire chapter of his Testament politique, his sort of a model, a treatise on how to behave diplomatically. There was an entire section on the art of continuous negotiation. So it was sort of a held political belief that you constantly negotiated with your foes or at least talked to them. So I think there are constantly similarities between that period and this period. And here we have Rubens, this really pragmatic, moderate figure trying to reform a society from within. And to me, that has resonance with the current administration. Whether you like it or not is another matter.
First, I know Goya's horrors of war, but Rubens also painted a horrors of war. Tell us about that painting. And also, you said that Goya might very well have been influenced by it directly.
Well, Rubens was one of the most generative artists in the world. He influenced painters, you know, year after year after year. And the consequences of war, which is now one of the great glories of the Pitti in Florence, is a painting that's been recycled. Its imagery has been recycled again and again and again because it's so powerful. It's about the consequences of destruction of man's choice to have conflict and what it means. And we see one of Rubens' most beautiful nudes, a Venus, in the center of this painting trying to restrain an angry Mars. And it's just a paint. We can see on the ground stepping figures stepping on books, and you know, architecture is endangered, is being crushed. There's a protractor. There's symbols of what this calamity means. There's a figure representing Europe screaming, coming out of sort of this doors of Janus, basically. And it's an incredibly powerful, moving painting that's influenced generations and generations of artists.
And something that it would have been very heartfelt for him to have painted this.
Yes, he painted this in a period after he had negotiated this treaty between England and Spain, and even after that, a sort of conflict had reignited, and the world was not learning lessons that he had hoped it would have learned about pragmatic, peaceful solutions to problems. So here, he had, at that point, essentially washed his hands of politics. He was frustrated and sort of returned to his studio, and then this was sort of one of his final masterpieces.
Well, Mark Lamster, thanks so much for joining us here and talking to us about your fascinating book. It's a terrific read, Master of Shadows, The Secret Diplomatic Career of the Painter Peter Paul Rubens.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Mark Lamster is also the author of Spalding's World Tour. It's about America's first cultural diplomats, a group of professional baseball players who went around the world in the late 19th century. You can also see Rubens' painting, Consequences of War, and you can hear Mark Lamster read an excerpt from his book, Master of Shadows. Just go to writersvoice.net. Coming up, we talk with S.J. Paris about her historical murder mystery, Heresy. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the previous segment, we traveled to the 17th century to talk about Peter Paul Rubens. Now we go a little further back in time, to the 16th century, with another story about an historical figure who also had a hidden career, Giordano Bruno. 16th century Europe was a battleground between old ways of thought and new, between the narrow dogmas of the medieval period and the birth of science in the Renaissance. The great Renaissance thinker Giordano Bruno was one of the emblematic figures and victims of the conflict. He was a Dominican friar who was excommunicated by the church for reading banned books. He wandered Europe teaching philosophy, mathematics, and writing a bestseller how-to book on memory tricks. He also was a pioneer in astronomy, perhaps the first European to understand that the universe was infinite. He was ultimately burned at the stake for his heretical, free-thinking views. In 1583, Bruno landed in England, where Queen Elizabeth ruled over a Protestant land roiled by Catholic plots to bring England back into the papal fold. One thing Bruno was doing there was spying on the Catholics. But he also went to Oxford in the hopes of getting a teaching post at the university there. S.J. Paris has written a murder mystery built around Bruno's visit to Oxford. It's called Heresy. Your novel Heresy takes a historical character, Giordano Bruno, and puts him in England on a mission, actually really a personal mission and a political mission. But first, tell us about Bruno.
Oh, well, I first read about Bruno, who was a real historical figure, as you say, years ago when I was at university and I was studying the Tudor period, and I came across him, you know, references to him. And I thought at the time what a fantastic character he would make for a book, just because he had this incredibly rich and varied life, and he was quite a romantic figure. He was a monk who, you know, he was a bit of a free thinker, and he had to run away from his monastery in Italy because he had all these unorthodox ideas about the universe being infinite. And he ended up being a fugitive, and he was in exile through Europe for many years and sort of traveled through most countries in Europe and just living on his wits, really. And he always struck me as a very rich character to put into fiction, but I hadn't really found a way of doing it. Because I thought to write a novel of his life would be, you know, it would end up being sort of 2,000 pages or something. And it was only a couple of years ago when I was looking into his life a bit more, and I came across a book which put forward the theory, which, you know, there's some debate about it, but there is this theory that while he was in England, he worked as a spy undercover for Queen Elizabeth's government. So immediately I thought, oh, that's it, that's what he's going to be doing.
He was in exile, as you said, throughout Europe. He was kind of on the lam from the Inquisition. Were they really actively pursuing him, or was he just not able to be in Italy?
Well, there were two things, really. Because he had published, well, first of all, he left his monastery because he was found with forbidden books books that won the Inquisition's Index of Forbidden Books. And these were really quite innocent things, actually. They weren't even, you know, it was things like Erasmus. You know, it wasn't even books of magic, which he did sort of go on to possess later. So he escaped from his monastery, which you were not allowed to do at the time. You weren't allowed to leave your order. So immediately he was excommunicated for having left his order without permission. And he had to sort of go on the run. Yeah, I think, you know, in reality, it wasn't. There weren't sort of packs of people tracking him down, but it was very difficult for him to work because his name was sort of known, you know, through, there was quite a network of communications between the monastic houses at the time, so it was very difficult for him to go in Italy. Certainly, he had to leave Italy in the end because it just seemed that everywhere he went, he was, you know, people knew who he was and where the Inquisition was sort of going to catch up with him.
He was a really phenomenal person, a Renaissance man, shall we say, in more ways than one, a philosopher, a scientist, really a brilliant scientist, a magician, and also a poet.
Yeah, he wrote wrote a play, he wrote a lot of poetry. He was one of the first writers, really, to sort of, you know, to write popular philosophy in a way. He wrote these, and in fact, some of his best books were written, or his best known books were written during the years he lived in England, which was the first time, really, that he had some peace, because obviously it was under Elizabeth I, it was a Protestant country. So the Inquisition, finally, he got out of Catholic Europe, and there was sort of no jurisdiction there for the Inquisition. So he had time to write these books, and he wrote, you know, a lot of books about philosophy, about cosmology, magic, what might be called sort of alchemy and natural magic. So yes, he had a wide range of interests. He was a really kind of fascinating character.
And I also read that he was excommunicated by Protestants, but I didn't find that in your book. I read that online. Is that true?
Well, he spent some time in Geneva, and he did a lot of teaching. He was a sort of itinerant teacher in some of the universities, and he managed to offend the Lutherans or the Calvinists in Geneva because some of his ideas were so kind of outlandish. I mean, he was almost a sort of pantheist. He wasn't even a Protestant. So a lot of his ideas offended the Protestants as much as the Catholics. And he got put in jail very briefly when he was in Geneva for saying something disobliging about the Protestant faith over there. So I think that was what made him particularly unusual, because he was sort of pursuing his own, almost his very own kind of religion, which was an amalgam of all sorts of sort of ancient wisdoms and quite progressive thoughts. He was one of the first people ever to suggest that the universe was infinite, for instance. So he was had some quite unusual ideas.
Yeah, he said, well, first of all, he wanted to bring the Catholics and Protestants together, and he wanted to base his religion on universal love and integration with nature. He seems like quite a modern man.
Well, it's strange now to think, you know, that a lot of the ideas that he was writing about, which were sort of utterly heretical and kind of unthinkable at the time, have actually become quite acceptable. Yes, the idea that one of his theories was that, you know, that we are all part of God, and that God is, you know, that the divinity is in everything in the universe, so that everything's interconnected, which is quite a sort of, you know, it's an idea that's become current, I think, from Eastern philosophies. And a lot of, he was very interested in the religion of the ancient Egyptians as well, so he took a lot of sort of ancient wisdom from that as well.
So you set your novel Heresy in Oxford around a debate. Well, this is a murder mystery, we have to say. Tell us why he's come to Oxford and who does he meet there?
Well, again, this was something that really happened. He was invited to the University of Oxford to take part in a public debate, and that was a very big part of university teaching at the time. You know, the students were taught in the art of debate, and these public debates, they were sort of almost the most popular form of entertainment for students in those days. You know, that people would get together and watch, listen to people debating, publicly debating contentious ideas. And so Bruno was invited to debate Copernicus's theory that the Earth orbited around the sun, which Bruno agreed with. And obviously the received wisdom at the time was that it was the other way around and that the Earth was the center of the universe. this really happened, and he went and he debated with a man called John Underhill, who is also one of the characters in the novel. Bruno had a miserable time in Oxford, and he always wrote about it with enormous bitterness afterwards, and so I wanted to try and fill in the blanks, and I wanted to try and construct a story that would explain why he'd had such an awful time and why he hated Oxford so much, apart from losing this debate quite ignominiously.
Yes, ignominiously indeed. Why did he lose it?
I think it's partly because the English at the time, and I'm not sure we're very much better in the intervening years, absolutely detested foreigners. They just thought foreigners were, you know, at best funny and comical, and at worst sort of, you know, dangerous. So the fact that, you know, there are accounts from the time saying that, you know, poor Bruno could barely get a sentence out without the whole of this debating hall just dissolving into giggles about his accent. So I think he was starting very much from a weak position. Nobody really wanted him to, you know, nobody wanted to hear his points. They just wanted to see him made a fool of, and so he was pretty angry about that. But I've added to that he gets embroiled in this series of horrible murders, which may well have a religious undertone.
Yeah, so tell us about the religious conflicts that were going on at that time. Queen Elizabeth was in power. And what was happening around that? She was, and of course, Henry VIII is the one who had made England Protestant, but there were still a lot of Catholics there.
Yeah, there was a big percentage of the people who were still Catholic and still sort of secretly loyal to the Roman Church. And the Protestant religion, I should say, the book's set in 1583, so Elizabeth's almost exactly halfway through her reign. She's been on the throne for 25 years. But the Protestant faith is still very vulnerable, and the Catholic powers, France and Spain in particular, backed by Rome, you know, there's constant rumours of invasion forces, and, you know, the Spanish and French kings getting a fleet together to invade, which actually happened later, obviously, with the Armada in 1588. But so at the time, England's a very nervous country. There's a lot of, you know, anxiety. There's a lot of conspiracies going on. There are Catholic seminaries in Europe training up these young men, you know, young men leaving England to go and train as priests in these European seminaries and then come back on sort of martyrdom missions in a way, you know, to try and convert people, and then often were put to death. And it's a time when there's a lot of unease, a lot of surveillance, and I think there's sort of parallels with you know, what's going on now. There's a real sort of nervousness that there might be these kind of cells of young men plotting to bring down the country around the place, and people are being encouraged to inform on their neighbours. And it was really sort of the beginning of modern intelligence. You know, modern espionage was at that time in England.
Wow, that's so a very paranoid time.
Yeah, very, very much so. And so into this comes Bruno, who is, because he's an outsider, he can sort of be all things to all men, and he can, you know, he can present himself as a Catholic if he wants to, or he can sort of go undercover, and, you know, he can win people's confidence. So this is the idea, is that that there were a lot of plots at the time to assassinate Elizabeth, and a lot of these young men had come out of the University of Oxford. There was it was quite a strong Catholic base, a sort of base of Catholic resistance at the time. So Bruno is, you know, part of what he's doing in Oxford is to try and root out some of these underground plots that are going on.
He has a more personal mission as well. Tell us about that, and did you base that on any kind of historical record?
Yes, he's looking for a book, a lost book, which is supposedly by the Egyptian Magus, Hermes Trismegistus, which is, you know, anybody who's sort of read books about occult histories will have come across this figure. I'm very interested, and this is quite a contentious issue because a lot of historians, you know, think that too much has been made of Bruno's interest in magic. But I like the idea that Bruno has this strange mix of ideas, some of them very modern and sort of scientific, and some actually quite sort of strange and esoteric. And there is a school of thought that says he was very interested in these sort of ancient philosophies. So I've got him going in search of this lost book of ancient Egyptian wisdom that will sort of give him the key to this theory that he's got about man becoming divine. So that's part of his mission in Oxford, is to find this book, which is considered very dangerous, because I also, that's an idea that fascinates me, the idea of books being banned because they're considered to be too powerful. So that's another sort of angle to the story. That's what he's looking for as well.
We're talking with S.J. Paris about her historical thriller, Heresy. It's about Giordano Bruno, his time in England, and how he solves a murder.
Now, we won't say a whole lot about the mystery because I have to say it's a rollicking good one. It keeps you guessing until the end, and we don't want to give anything away. But is there anything that you'd like to say about the plot?
What I particularly enjoyed about writing it was that it's very much based on the old sort of classic detective stories, because you've got this... the community of an Oxford college, certainly at the time, it's a closed community. There's only a sort of there's a limited number of people there. Generally, the doors are locked. There's a sort of limit to who can get in and out. And so, when someone is murdered within the college, is found dead and in suspicious circumstances, then it's like the sort of old country house murder that Agatha Christie used to do so well, that, you know, you've immediately got this group of people, and it must have been one of them. It could only have been one of this part of these community living in the college. So it was fun to write that, because in a way it was sort of taking in that old classic detective story tradition, which I've always loved.
And we should say now that you are writing under a pseudonym here, S.J. Paris.
I am.
Why?
Well, because in England, really, it was partly because I'm a journalist in England. I've been a journalist for 12 years, and I've written some other books. And in a way, this is something completely different. It's something that I've always wanted to do. But I think particularly with sort of crime novels or with thrillers, sometimes they have quite a different readership. And so it wasn't ever about sort of hiding my identity. It was just about signaling to readers that this is a very particular kind of book, and this is what you can expect when you pick up a book by S.J. Paris, and not to confuse it with other things that I've written before. That was really just the way of doing it.
And it's in a grand tradition as well to do
that.
Yes,
there's many writers, even contemporary writers now, who will write, use different names for different styles of books. And I think it makes sense in a way, and it certainly makes it easier for booksellers, I think, as well, just to be able to sort of know immediately what kind of book you're dealing with.
Now, one of your other books was a memoir, The Devil Within. It was about your experiences living with depression.
Yeah, that was the last or previous book to this one.
What was it like to shift from, that must have been a difficult book in some ways to write, just to write about something that is painful, the very title of it, shows that, and then to move to something that is so much lighter?
Yeah, that was partly the thinking behind it, because I'd written two novels which were both sort of had elements of my own experience in, and then I'd written this memoir, and I just thought, that's enough, enough about me. I wanted to write something that was completely different and completely removed from my own experience. Although it's funny, because in a way, as an author, you can never remove yourself from what you're writing. So. And there's parts of Bruno, I think, that I'm sure there's sort of part of myself that I put into him, because I imagine, trying to imagine the experience of somebody who has had to live in exile for a number of years, I think there's a sort of melancholy aspect to Bruno, but just because of the situation that he's living in. And there's a sort of wistfulness to him that I think, I probably have brought some of my own experience to bear on that. But it was just really, very refreshing and enormously enjoyable just to be able to write something that required a lot of research and time spent in libraries, and not having to, as you say, it was a much less painful, much more enjoyable process of writing this one.
So you really cover a whole range of genres, journalism being one, memoir, and now novels, but two different genres within novels. Do you find that shifting the style of writing, shifting in this way, is something that takes a certain amount of effort to do, or do you feel that the different ways that you write actually can inform each other?
No, it does take quite a bit of effort, actually. And I find when I'm writing a novel, I just do sort of try and cut back on everything else that I'm doing, because the way that I work best is to sort of immerse myself in that and in that world, and particularly with this, with Heresy, because it was a historical thing. You know, I had to sort of try and imagine myself into that world.
Now, back to Heresy, there's just one question I have. I mean, I knew from the beginning, even though I didn't really know, I know a lot more about Giordano Bruno now after having read this book than before, but I did know that he was burned at the stake. And that's pretty much elided in this book.
Oh, well, it's because it's going to be a series, and it's written, because it's written from his perspective, there are references to it, but I didn't want to, you know, in the first book of a series, I didn't, it didn't fit to have talked about his death. Yeah, eventually, the Inquisition caught up with him, and, anybody who sort of looks him up can find that out, and he did go back to Italy, and he was subjected to a very lengthy trial, which is, in fact, where we get, you know, a lot of the information about his life has come from the records of this trial. But that will be for later.
The book is Mystery, and we've been talking with S.J. Paris. Thanks so much for joining us here.
Thanks very much.
S.J. Paris also writes under her real name, Stephanie Merritt. You can read an excerpt from Heresy by going to writersvoice.net. During our interview, we mentioned the mythical ancient Egyptian sage, Hermes Trismegistus. He was said to have written 50,000 books and to have been both a god and a mortal. Let's listen to poet Richard Wilbur reading his poem about Trismegistus, recorded when we visited him at his home in Cummington, Massachusetts. He gives a short introduction and then reads it.
It begins with a quotation from the great Lament of Hermes, and I'm indebted for these words to Francis Yates, who quoted them first. O Egypt, Egypt, so the great lament of thrice great Hermes went. Nothing of thy religion shall remain save fables which thy children shall disdain. His grieving eye foresaw the world's bright fabric overthrown, which married star to stone and charged all things with awe. And what in that dismantled world could be more fabulous than he? Had he existed, was he but a name tacked on to forgeries which pressed the claim of every ancient quack, that one could from a smoky cell, by talisman or spell, coerce the zodiac? Still, still, we summon him at midnight hour to Milton's pensive tower, and hear him tell again how then and now creation is a house of mirrors, how each herb that sips the dew dazzles the eye with many small reflections of the all, which, after all, is true.
Richard Wilbur, reading Hermes Trismegistus. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.